How will you disrupt yourself? How will you disrupt yourself? How will you disrupt yourself?
Welcome to the Disrupt Yourself podcast. I'm Whitney Johnson. I think, write, speak, and live all things disruption. In episode 80, we provided you with an overview of the 7-point framework of personal disruption. In episode 100, we then did a deep dive on the first point or accelerant number one, taking the right kinds of risks. Collectively, these are our two most listened to episodes. So to say thank you for listening, in this episode, we'll do a deep dive on accelerant number two, play to your distinctive strengths. Let me start by telling you a story. A few years ago, our family watched the film 100-Foot Journey, in which the Kadam family, seeking asylum due to election disputes in India, they emigrate to a small village in France. The father, he purchases an abandoned restaurant 100 feet away from an upscale French restaurant. The second oldest son, Hassan, is a talented chef. His specialty, not surprisingly, is Indian cooking. But to gain stature as a chef in France, he must master the French tradition. Once he does, he begins to infuse his food with Indian spices and flavors. His ability to cook French Indian cuisine becomes his distinctive strength, something he does well that others don't. And it earns him the coveted Michelin Award. Distinctive strengths. That's what we're going to talk about in this podcast episode. You walk through the door of the market opportunity that you've created by taking the right risks, like we talked about in episode 100, which is accelerant number one, by then playing to your distinctive strengths, which is accelerant number two in the framework of personal disruption. So here's how we're going to do it. We're going to first talk about what a distinctive strength is or define it. Secondly, we'll provide you with 8 clues to help you find some of your hidden strengths. Third, we'll talk about how to use your strengths in distinctive ways. And fourth, we'll explain how to leverage the strengths of people around you. That's how you're going to speed up your current S-curve of learning, how you become a high-growth individual by focusing on what you do uniquely well. So let's start by defining the term distinctive strengths. And we'll do that by talking about the koala. This cuddly little animal sleeps. It actually sleeps up to 20 hours a day. So you could have serious doubts about its ability to survive, except that the koala can eat something almost no other animal can. It eats eucalyptus leaves, which are poisonous to every other animal on the planet, except for the koala. This is its distinctive strength, something it does well that others don't. But what you do well that others don't isn't always going to be so obvious. Think about Charles Darwin and his finches. After gathering numerous specimens of finches on the Galapagos Islands and presenting them to John Gould, an expert on birds, Gould told Darwin that what looked like at first glance just finches were 12 different species. There were similarities, but evolution had allowed them to develop distinctive strengths. Each species had a novel beak structure that allowed it to exploit a specific food resource. Some evolved to eat seeds, others fruit, others insects. In business terms, they all had similar core competencies: feathers, wings, feet, beak. But it was a distinctive, seemingly subtle strength, the shape of the beak, that allowed the finches to compete effectively for a specific type of food. Rather than foraging for food where all the other birds were foraging, they foraged where others weren't because of their distinctive strengths. So at a high level, a distinctive strength is something you do well that others don't, but it's hard to do this if you don't know what your strengths are. You may have an obvious advantage like the koala, but most of us need to do some hunting and pecking like with Darwin's finches. So that's what we're going to do for the next few minutes. Think of it like a treasure hunt for your strengths. I'm going to give you 8 clues, which we'll include in a worksheet, and these clues are in the form of questions illustrated by stories. Question or clue number one, what skills have helped you survive, especially those that helped you survive as a child? Listen to this story about Scott Ettinger, a consultant and CEO advisor who earns over $1 million a year. Scott never knew his father. He grew up broke, living in a trailer park. At age 9, his mother also left. He was adopted, but still lived in less than ideal circumstances. Scott learned to survive this difficult childhood by becoming an expert in communication, conflict resolution, attunement to others, and raw persuasion. In high school and then in college, with the help of a few great teachers, Scott discovers that this ability to communicate and to persuade is incredibly valuable. He places in the top five in over 100 debate tournaments and then studies communication and rhetoric in college. Scott has since been ranked number 2 globally in sales in a division of a Fortune 500 company. And how does he now earn $1 million a year? Well, he helps Fortune 500 companies turn around underperforming divisions by focusing on a critical survival skill in business, how to sell. Now, let me ask you, what do you do well? Because you needed a skill, this skill, to survive, whether physically or emotionally. Your circumstances may have been more dire than Scott's. Maybe they were less. It doesn't matter, because for you, they were hard. So what was this lifeline skill? Question or clue number 2, what makes you feel strong? Marcus Buckingham, who is the world's leading expert on strengths, has said that our strengths clamor for our attention in the most basic way. Using them makes us feel invigorated, inquisitive, successful. If you don't know what makes you feel strong, here's something you can do. As you go throughout today, the next week, when you finish something up, whether at home or work, make a note of how you feel. Do you have more energy? Do you feel invigorated? Or do you feel exhausted and depleted? Look for where you have more energy. You're going to begin to see a pattern. And that pattern creates clues pointing in the direction of your strengths. There's something else that I want to add here that I think is important, and it came to my attention when I interviewed Marcus Buckingham in episode 112. Here's what he had to say. He said that at the microscopic level, learning appears to be a function of neurogenesis, or the growth of new neurons. The brain never loses its ability to create more neurons and connections, no matter how old you are, between those neurons. This is neuroplasticity. What's interesting and ultimately pretty intuitive is that when we examine a brain's growth, you grow more neurons and connections where you already have the most pre-existing neurons and connections. Every brain grows most where it's already the strongest. In other words, you need to know what your weaknesses are so that you can mitigate them and avoid getting derailed. But it's the doubling down, the tripling down on your strengths that's key to accelerating up your curve to becoming a high-growth individual. Clue number 3, what exasperates you? Entrepreneur Lana Cates identifies her strengths by noting when she feels exasperated. She says, "The frustration of genius is believing if it's easy for you, it must be easy for everyone else." Former CEO of Ford, Alan Mulally, has been asked how he turned Ford around, how the stock price increased from $1 to $18 under his watch. He'll then describe a management system that he calls working together. He frequently says, after that, "Well, everyone knows this. Anyone can do this." Well, not everyone knows it, and not everyone can do it, Alan. That's why he was named one of the greatest CEOs of our time. Let me tell you another story. Christy was a new executive assistant to a small business president. She was frustrated at the poor training the outgoing assistant gave her, exasperated that the people around her weren't more exacting. With contracts, for example, she was told, "Just print out the old contracts and send them out." But Christy took the time to read the contracts and saw that many included agreed-upon price increases that hadn't been implemented. Because of her precise eye, contract revenue went up and she received a nice bonus. When are you exasperated or frustrated? If you hear yourself saying or thinking, "Everyone knows how to do this. This is just common sense," and you can't tell people how to do what you want done because you don't know how you know, these are all markers or indicators that you're bumping against one of your strengths. And because it's easy for you and not for the people around you, it's a distinctive strength. Clue number 4, what made you an oddball as a child? On this one, I'm going to tell you 3 quick stories. The first is about Kari Anderson. As a child, Kari was diagnosed as publicly shy and a stutterer. In high school, a kind teacher said to her, "You don't like to stand up and answer questions, so I'm going to put you on the newspaper where you can just ask questions one-on-one and write it up." Turned out, She was really good at it, in part because she had seen her father model curiosity, but also because it shifted the focus away from her. When she finished her first interview, her teacher and friend said, "Did you realize that during this whole interview, you only stuttered twice?" Kari has gone on to become an Emmy Award-winning journalist. She worked for the Wall Street Journal, and get this, she's given a TED Talk with over 2.5 million views. Kari's stutter may have made her odd as a child, but it's given birth to her superpower. Second example is Alden Mills. As a boy, he had asthma. He had two left feet. He was terrible at anything that involved a ball. He was slow, and kids tease him mercilessly about his thunder thighs. But when he's a freshman in high school, a coach lines up all the kids. He looks at Alden's legs and says, "Hey, you have rower's legs." So Alden starts rowing. Combined with the grit he's developed in dealing with his asthma, his sophomore year in high school, he manages to make the varsity team, and he's only a sophomore. Alden goes on to become a Navy SEAL, the CEO and founder of Perfect Fitness, which makes the product for a perfect push-up, a $100 million in sales company. The thing that made him odd, his thunder thighs, he thought they were liabilities. Turns out, they were a strength. Story number three. This is about Lovey Ajayi. She's female, Black, a U.S. immigrant from Nigeria, a devout Christian, and has a name that no one can pronounce. What made her odd as a child, as an adult, has become her distinctive strength, especially as she combines this with her lifeline skill, which was and is her sense of humor. Lovey's debut book, I'm Judging You, was released to critical acclaim in 2016 and became an instant New York Times bestseller. What's the thing that you wanted to go away as a child? Because you just wanted to fit in. Every single one of you listening has something. It's the thing that kids made fun of, the thing that was a source of embarrassment, possibly even shame. Yeah, that thing. What you do uniquely and exceptionally well today is very likely possible because of what made you odd as a child. Or as Liz Strauss once said, what if everything you think is wrong with you is really a superpower? Clue number five, what compliments do you dismiss or just sort of shrug off? This is one of my favorite clues. It's so revealing, but it's also problematic because while 90% of us like praise because it makes us feel valued, 70% of us associate discomfort with praise, which means that every time you get a compliment that could be helpful to you in helping you know what your strengths are, you're so uncomfortable, you immediately forget it. So here's a tip to start remembering compliments from writer Christopher Littlefield. He says, when someone compliments you, it's more about them than about you. They're not asking if you agree. They're giving you a gift. They're saying, here's how you impacted me. If you received a birthday gift you didn't like, no matter how ugly or seemingly useless to you, you would never throw it back in the person's face. So the next time someone gives you a compliment, picture in your mind a gift-wrapped box. Accept the gift, open it, say thank you, then place it in a corner of one of your favorite rooms. The next compliment is another gift. You receive gift after gift. It will become a stack of presents, a totem that tells you how you impact your corner of the world, your strengths. This is the image that I want you to have in your mind. Now, as a practical matter, I want you to write down what people say immediately because this is your genius, whatever that compliment is. Let me give you some color around this. So during my consulting work at a large technology company, one man raises his hand and he says, well, people tell me that I'm nice. He, by the way, did not like that compliment. It almost felt like a pejorative, I'm nice. That often happens with compliments. If we haven't deflected it because it's uncomfortable, we dismiss it because it's not what we want to hear. You've heard it so many times, you're tired of it. Why can't people just compliment you on things that you're trying hard to be good at? But to this man who was told he is nice, the gift that people were giving him is, there's no drama with you. I like collaborating with you. We get things done when we work with you. There's a lot of information in that single phrase, you are nice. It may be as reflexive as breathing for you. It doesn't mean that what you do well, what is easy for you, isn't hugely valuable. And by the way, I'm willing to bet that the compliment you get a lot is somehow tied to what made you an oddball as a child or helped you survive. Usually, they're related. At this point, we're more than halfway through the clues. And so you really want to be thinking about what's helped you survive, what makes you feel strong, what exasperates you as a child, what made you odd, and then pay attention to the compliments you receive. This is a good time to remind you that you don't need to do all of this at once. You're going to listen, I hope, to this recording every day for at least a week. So just pick one thing to do in a day because there's a lot here. After listening, though, you might feel like you've learned, but the real learning is going to happen when you do. So pick one thing, like today, I'm going to note when I felt strong. When you do even one thing differently for 15 seconds today, that's a win. Now, let's continue with clue number 6. What are some of your hard-won skills? This might relate to your childhood and survival, but I'm thinking about things you've gotten good at as an adult because the situation required it of you. For example, I recently received an email from my friend Pam Eager. She's caring for her aging mother-in-law. Pam didn't say this. She never would. But I can only imagine that this work of caring for someone who's aging is unrelenting, never-ending, sometimes frustrating, often draining, and physically exhausting. I doubt this was her plan, but does she know how to persist? Does she have grit? Does she do it with grace and compassion? 100%. What about being a parent? I love what Anne Crittenden said. She said, "What could be a greater transformational act than turning a drooling, demanding baby into a thinking, compassionate, hardworking, law-abiding adult?" Clearly, a parent who accomplishes this, who helps a child develop to their fullest potential, is the original transformative leader. I don't think that most people, when they conceive a child, think, "This is going to teach me how to be a transformative leader." And yet, that's what can happen. So, what situations have you been in that have required you to do something hard? Perhaps it's something like caring for a parent or a child. Maybe it's something more benign, like I needed to learn Spanish when I lived in Uruguay as a missionary. Whatever it is, how has that thing that you did out of necessity evolved into a strength? Clue number 7. What do you think about when there is nothing that you have to think about? This is the question that revealed to me that I wouldn't be investing for a living forever, which was hard because I liked being able to say, "I'm an investor." It made me feel important. Sure, I built a decent financial model, and yes, I was good at picking stocks, but I didn't think about the market when I didn't have to, and I know people who do. I was and am far more interested in the human condition and investing in people. In fact, when I was still an equity analyst, this was around 2002, I had just read Tom Peters' article, A Brand Called You. American Idol was at this point peaking in popularity, and so during one of our training meetings, I started the meeting by talking about how American Idol contestants had a brand, the diva, the comeback kid, the oddball. I then asked everyone in the room, all the analysts, to think about their brand. Are you a stock picker, an industry expert, a connector? I loved preparing this presentation. It wasn't part of my job, but I spent every spare minute I had thinking about it and the implications for my colleagues. Several years later, when I was now investing alongside Clayton Christensen, slowly making the transition to what I do now, a friend, Chrisula Weiniger, said to me, "You invest in stocks, people, concepts, and dreams." Bingo. What do you think about when there's nothing you have to think about? Whatever it is, you're doing it because it invigorates you. It makes you feel strong. It's a strength. Remember, how much money you make, what you are able to accomplish in life is not only a function of how much need or want there is for what you do, but how well you do it, which is a function of how much time you passionately, devotedly spend doing it. What you do when there's nothing you have to do. Clue number 8. What are your values? What matters to you, what you believe about the world, is a source of strength. Whether you come from a strong religious tradition or not, you have a basic foundation of principles and beliefs that guide your actions, and they're an essential part of your truest self. Because, as with strengths generally, what you value can feel a little invisible to you, here are 2 suggestions or tips to figure out what you value. The first suggestion or tip is to track your time for several weeks. After interviewing Laura Vanderkam for this podcast, I tracked my time in 15-minute increments for a period of 6 weeks. What I learned or reconfirmed is that I value my work deeply. I value time to study. I value my faith. I value sleep. And I value my family more than I thought I did, meaning I spend more time with my family than I thought I spent. As you observe how you spend your time, you'll know what you value. That's suggestion or tip number one. Tip number two to figure out what you value or who you aspire to be is to start collecting quotes or lyrics that you like or even love. To get you started, here are a few of my favorites. The first quote is from Samuel Johnson. He said, "To be happy at home is the ultimate result of all ambition. I am very driven, but when I start peeling back why I do what I do, it's to be happy at home with the people that I love." The second quote is this: "You can bet your life and that, and twice as double, that God knew exactly where he wanted you to be placed." This is from Stevie Wonder. Like him, I take the long view. What we're experiencing now on this planet is just a sliver of our existence. But for the moment, we are where we're supposed to be so we can learn what we need to learn and help who we need to help. It also reminds me that who we are and what we do matters. The third quote is from Lady Galadriel in Lord of the Rings when she says, "I passed the test." When Frodo, encouraged by her goodness and wisdom, offers her the ring, she wants to accept it desperately. She says, "I do not deny that my heart has greatly desired to ask what you offer, and now at last it comes. I shall be beautiful and terrible as the morning and the night, stronger than the foundations of the earth. All shall love me and despair. No matter how much I may desire to do good, once I have that power, I know it can corrupt me. I want to pass the test as Galadriel did." The fourth quote is from Anne Voskamp. She says, "Inconvenience is the proof of love. You love as well as you are willing to be inconvenienced." This is hugely helpful to me because, well, I feel inconvenienced a lot. Maybe you do too. So if you want to know what you value, you can track your time. You might want to start by doing this for just 24 hours. What you do, again, is an indicator of what you value. If you want to do more on this, we'll include a link to our interview with Laura Vanderkam and to her website in the show notes. The second way to know what you value is to write down quotes or lyrics that you love. If nothing immediately comes to mind, as you come across quotes on social media that you find yourself saying yes, or you're resharing this will get you started with knowing who you aspire to be. So let's do a quick recap of the 8 clues that will help you figure out what your strengths are. Number 1, what skills have helped you survive? Number 2, what makes you feel strong? 3, what exasperates you? 4, what made you an oddball as a child? 5, what compliments do you dismiss, do you shrug off? 6, what are your hard-won skills? 7, what do you think about when you have nothing that you have to think about? And 8, what do you value? Just like with the finches who have multiple ways to forage for food depending on their beak, there are so many ways for you to be strong, to be smart. The trick is, once you know what your strengths are, is to value them, to use them deliberately, on purpose. Or as James Oppenheim said, the foolish man seeks happiness in the distance, the wise just under her feet. So, knowing your distinctive strengths, now you know what they are, that's one thing. But leveraging them so that you can become a higher growth individual, accelerating up your current S-curve faster, is another. So I want to tell you now 5 stories of what this might look like as you leverage what you do uniquely well. Story number 1. Because Aussie Barak was a strong student, his friends and family expected he would study science in school, math, physics, chemistry. Instead, he studied Arabic, not a typical move for an Israeli. And he took a lot of flack, but it was a skill that his classmates didn't have, that led him to army service in an intelligence unit. After serving as a captain in the Israeli Defense Forces, there is the expectation that Aussie will go into tech or VC, following the footsteps of his father, who was a founder of venture capital in Israel. Instead, he goes to the U.S. to study the art of video games at Carnegie Mellon. As a child, he loved art. He used it to make sense of the world. When he is now tasked with producing a video game, there's no Grand Theft Auto for him. He wants to produce a game called Peacemaker, a single-player game, this was 15 years ago, where you would be the Palestinian president or the Israeli prime minister and then have to make decisions real-time. Because of Ozzy's distinctive strengths, an artist with military training, an Israeli who speaks Arabic, he was able to produce a game about which people have said, by playing Peacemaker, I've learned more about the Middle East than I learned by watching the news for months. What is something you do well, like speaking another language, whether it's Arabic or art, that if you could swim in slightly different waters would be even more valuable? Story number two. When Janie Juvan was a second-year law associate, her mother got sick with cancer. In trying to understand what was happening, she goes online and discovers a huge support group. At the same time, as a new associate, her law firm had a requirement around networking. She couldn't go out at night because she was with her mom, so she thought, well, why don't I network online? Janie starts with Twitter. The partners wonder, what is she doing? Law firms tend to be conservative, and besides, why would she play where no one else is? Remember, this is almost 15 years ago, but she persisted. And because she did, when the economy came crashing down in 2008, she'd landed clients on social media. She was able to sidestep layoffs. And when she was up for partner, she made a compelling case. Now I'll ask you, what's something you could do or are doing, perhaps out of necessity, like with Janie, that may not make sense in the short term, but in the long term, it might? Story number three, Horace Dediu. He is a U.S.-Romanian citizen. He's had a lifelong passion for smartphones and believed that phones would disrupt the PC world. So he got a job at Nokia in Finland. But that wasn't the disruption. Instead, it was the computing companies that took all the money out of telecom. So after a decade at Nokia, he turned his knowledge of the disrupted Nokia to think about the disruptor, Apple. And because of his willingness to iterate out loud, something that Wall Street analysts can't really do, he's become a preeminent analyst of Apple, known for his spot-on financial predictions. How might your domain expertise, if applied in a different industry, allow you to make an unusual contribution? Story number four. Sean Askenazi is a defense attorney turned chocolate maker. As a trial lawyer, Sean never lost a case. But being good at the law also meant he had to deal with death threats, a lot of them. He overcame his fear through his sense of conviction, his belief in what was right. Resolve or conviction may not seem like the attribute of a chocolate maker, but it certainly is the attribute for the kind of chocolate maker that Sean wants to be, one that does direct trade, one that is connected to his customers and suppliers. So despite the siren song of fame and fortune that beckons to him, he has remained small. For Sean, chocolate is a spiritual practice. Staying true to this vision takes conviction. In Sean's case, it's not domain expertise that's distinctive, though undoubtedly his legal expertise has been helpful in negotiating direct trade, but there's also his conviction. How might a leadership skill, commonly mislabeled as a soft skill, be the skill that sets you apart in a possibly crowded field? Or simply give you the courage to play where others aren't, like deciding to keep your business small because you know it's the right decision for you? Story number five. From the time Susan Cain was very young, she realized that she felt differently. How she liked to spend her time wasn't the preferred social structure, like getting on a bus to go to camp, this loud, boisterous environment. We're going to do this. That wasn't her thing. And she wondered, is it okay to feel this way? After she left the law to become a writer full-time, she started writing about how she felt, what it was like to be an introvert. It was at the time weird, idiosyncratic. But because she was willing to explore and leverage her strength of what made her odd, that of being an introvert, in a crowded field of extrovert-related literature and how to lead, her book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, it stood out. Quiet was a runaway bestseller, one of the most popular books of 2014. Susan's experience comes back to what made you feel odd as a child. What didn't make sense? Did it need to be that way? Turn it over. Understand it. Really give this some thought. Once you have a sense of what you do well, how can you apply that in unusual ways? You don't need to change jobs or roles, though you might, but start with where you are. Maybe you're like Ossie. At a young age, he had that talent for drawing, but he put it away. You might have had a similar experience or something you did well, you've set it aside. But now that you have the table stakes qualifications to do your job, how can you pull in that natural talent or gift to help you do the job superbly and unusually well? Perhaps you're like Janie. Out of necessity, you start doing something like social media, but now that you know how to do something that others don't, what possibilities are there for you? For Horace, he thought technology was going one way, but then it shifted. How can you apply what you learned at one company or organization in an entirely new setting in a way that surprises others and delights you? If, like Sean, you've decided to do something new, like become an entrepreneur, you may be thinking, I'm done, no more law, clean slate. But remember, you spent a lot of your life learning how to do what you did. So how can you use your understanding of what you've done in the past to help you do what you want to do now? Finally, if you're like Susan and you want to find your voice to write, to speak, to share what you know, reflect on what you've been wrestling with your entire life and ask, does it need to be this way? Over time, you'll have to figure out how to universalize your ideas so it's no longer your experience, but the human experience. But if you start with what made you odd, you know it's distinctive. That's a good place to start. Now, we've talked about how to identify your strengths, how to play to your strengths where others aren't, and the two in play with one another become a flywheel for climbing your current S-curve for becoming a high-growth individual. Let's now talk about what this means for you as a leader. It's logical to think that the people you work with will want to play to their strengths. Why wouldn't they want to flex their strongest muscle? But it's easier said than done, not because you can't easily pinpoint what they do well, but because they don't value their strengths. If it's easy, how could it be valuable? And if you want them to spend time doing something that they don't value, maybe you don't value them. So it's a lot harder than it sounds. Let me tell you a story to illustrate what I mean. If you watch football, you will see the coaches talking to each other over headsets during the game. What you didn't know is that during the 2016 season, the NFL made major league-wide improvements to its radio frequency technology, both to prevent interference from media using the same frequency and to prevent tampering. This was a development led by John Cave, VP of Football Technology at the NFL. It's been incredibly helpful to the coaches, but it might not have ever been built, or at least Cave wouldn't have built it, had it not been for his boss, Michelle McKenna Doyle, CIO of the NFL. When Michelle was hired, she observed that a number of people on her team were struggling, not because they weren't talented, but because they were in roles that weren't suited to their strengths. After doing a deep analysis, Michelle started having people switch jobs. For many, this reshuffling was unwelcome and downright uncomfortable. This is what happened with Cave. He had the talent to create products and build things, but he didn't have the time to do it because he had this big job of system development, including enterprise systems. But Michelle was asking herself, why is John weighed down with the payroll system when he could figure out how to evolve the game through technology? She saw a better role for his strengths. The coaches wanted to talk to each other. The technology didn't exist. She wanted Cave to create it. At first, he was concerned because his overall span was shrinking. He felt like he was being demoted. But Michelle said to him, "Trust me, you're going to be a great innovator." And he is. Often superpowers, there are these things that we do effortlessly, reflexively, like breathing. So when you ask people to use their genius, they may think, but that's so easy, it's too easy. So instead of feeling like you value them, they think you don't actually trust them. As a leader, it's your job to not only spot talent, but to convince people that you value their strengths and they should too. One way to do this is to identify and talk about strengths as a team. Brett Gerstenblatt, VP and Creative Director at CVS, has his team take a personality assessment. In this case, it's StrengthsFinder. Then he asks them to post their top five strengths somewhere at their desk or on their computer. Brett wants people to wear their strengths like a badge, not to tell others why they're great, but to remind them to use them. Diana Newton Anderson, an entrepreneur turned social good activist at Unique Foundation, shares a story of her college basketball coach who had her team take shots from different places on the court, the key, the elbow, the paint. He would then record their percentages and have every person on the team memorize those percentages. This would allow the team to literally play to each other's strengths. You can do something similar with your team. Or if you want to go really deep, I learned in my podcast interview with Zach Obrant, a co-founder of Scribewriting, that at their company's offsites, they do an in-depth analysis of everyone's strengths. Two times a year, the remote team comes into town, and the core of that few days is to think about strengths and obstacles. They sit in a big group, each person writes up their strengths, and then everyone in the room adds to that list. It takes about 2 to 2.5 hours. The idea is to support you in who you want to become. We'll include a worksheet if you want to do this in detail, but here are some things that you can do right now. First, write down 1 to 2 strengths for each person on your team. Don't think too hard. It should be top of mind. Second, ask yourself, do you value this strength? As in, are they good at something that you think is valuable? We tend to have certain skills that we think are more valuable than other skills. And if we think they're good at something that we value, then we may preference them over other people. So it's just something for you to be aware of. Third, ask yourself, do they value this skill? Do they recognize their superpower and really use it deliberately and on purpose? 4, analyze, is this person in a role suited to their strengths? 5, wear your strengths like a badge. Post them so that people can play to those strengths. 6, start to measure new ideas, products, or projects against your collective superpowers, asking, will this initiative leverage what we as a team do uniquely well? When your team feels strong, they're willing to play where others aren't, to take on market risk, to work on projects, ideas for which there isn't yet a market. As we start to wrap up, now here are 6 things I'd like you to do. 1, listen to this module every day for a week. And when you get ideas, write them down, even if they're random, and then pick one a day that you'll act on. 2, write down compliments as soon as you get them. Make a note on your phone. If it's one you especially love and you're feeling cheeky, ask the person to repeat it so you can record it. I've done that, and I'm glad I did. 3, be aware when you're exasperated or you say, this is just common sense or everyone knows how to do this. Just say to yourself, aha, this is something I do unusually well. 4, observe how you spend your time. Are you spending most of your time doing things that make you feel strong? It's not that you can't or shouldn't do hard things, but as you do those hard things, leverage your gifts, your talents, your very own beak, looking for opportunities to create rather than to compete. 5, observe the strengths of people around you. What can you do to nudge them toward using those strengths more deliberately? 6, how does your big goal, your grand plan, play to your strengths? How can you tweak that goal to better leverage those strengths? And if it doesn't require what you do brilliantly well, is it the right goal? No matter what your goals are, whether you are listening to this for you or because you're trying to build a better team or a better organization, remember that the organization, even the team, doesn't change as a group. You change as individuals because the fundamental unit of disruption is the individual. For you to close your knowing-doing gap, for change to truly happen, you'll need to listen to this over and again. Emotionalize it. Intellectual assent is a good starting point, but for real change to happen, you need to buy in from your heart, the seat of emotions, your unconscious mind, because that's where your behavior is governed, and that requires repetition. Be honest with yourself about what you want. Don't edit. It's okay if you don't know how to do what you want to do. That's part of the fun, is figuring out how to get what you want. As you make your plan, focus on being a creator, not a competitor, not going after what others have, but creating what you want. Leverage what you do well, what you do uniquely well, your distinctive strengths, to get what you want. Let me close now with another of my favorite quotes. It's from Ralph Waldo Emerson. He said, "Rings and jewels are not gifts, but apologies for gifts. The only gift is a portion of thyself." That's how you build momentum to climb your learning curve. That's how you become a high-growth individual. That's how you create something grand. Thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you to sound engineer Whitney Job, producer manager Macy Robison, content contributors Emily Davis and Nancy Wilson, and art director Brandon Jameson. I'm Whitney Johnson, and use your strengths, play to your distinctive strengths to disrupt yourself. Disruption.